RFI. You're listening to Radio France International. To the Democratic Republic of Congo now, where opposition politicians have called for civil disobedience after the Electoral Commission announced this week that there would be no presidential election before 2019. The Commission's announcement marks the end of an agreement reached late last year under which elections were to be held this year. To explain the situation for us, we now cross to our correspondent Philip Kleinfeld in Kinshasa. Philip, good morning. The Congolese Electoral Commission says it needs another 500 days to organise election. Why is this?
Good morning. Yeah, so the crux of the problem here is that the Congolese Electoral Commission, which is called CENI, is widely distrusted by the population. Its president, a guy called Cornel Nanga, and its vice president, neither of them are seen as independent. The whole institution is perceived to have been compromised by Kabila, the president, and is considered to be acting to keep him in power. Now, given its sort of lack of political will to actually organize elections, with 3 months to go until the accord, December 31st accord, which said elections would be held this year, expires, it faces an absolute mountain of technical challenges, none of which it appears particularly willing to tackle. So to give you a flavour of what those technical challenges are, firstly, you have voter registration. This is yet to be completed in Kasai and Kasai Central. These are areas which have been affected by conflicts over the last year. Each registration centre there needs to be open for 90 days, possibly longer. That alone is likely to take CENI beyond this December 31st deadline. Then you have the Congolese diaspora, the Congolese that are living abroad. No plan seems to exist for enrolling them, based on an interview I did recently with CENI's spokesperson. Then you have the processing stage. The data needs to be brought from the field to Kinshasa. It needs to be consolidated and cleaned so that cases where individuals have registered once, twice, three times, possibly even more, are eliminated. As of yet, CENI hasn't procured the software required to do that, and the processing itself could take months to pull off. Then you have to print the ballots, which, given the number of candidates standing, look more like telephone directories in DRC. And then you have to pull off the logistical budgetary nightmare, which is actually holding three elections, because three are being held here, presidential, legislative, and provincial, all at the same time, something that's never been attempted before in the DRC.
Philip, we're running a little short of time. I'm sorry to cut in there. I just wanted to get briefly, if we could, a bit of the opposition reaction from politicians and other Congolese reaction to the news.
Sure, yeah. So on Thursday, you have Félix Tshisekedi, who's the head of the UDPS, one of the largest opposition parties here, say that Kabila and Nanga, the president of the Electoral Commission, have both declared war on the Congolese people. And he described Nanga as a servant to Kabila. And that follows an increasingly kind of robust posture that we've seen being adopted by elements of the opposition coalition, which is called the Rassemblement. The UDPS is now saying, which leads up the Rassemblement coalition, is now saying that there will be no third dialogue, there will be no transition with Kabila, and that the population should try and render the DRC ungovernable. There are other opposition parties which do strike a more conciliatory tone, but it's kind of difficult to envisage what comes next when the December 31st accord expires.
Okay, Philip, thank you very much for that. Our correspondent Philip Kleinfeld in Kinshasa there. Now, the UK, France and Germany have vowed to stand by the Iran nuclear deal despite US President Donald Trump's decision to decertify the agreement. Along with Washington's European allies, Russia and China also said they would uphold the 2015 treaty. Trump's move is not a withdrawal from the deal, which US Congress requires the president to certify every 3 months. But without certification, Congress could reimpose sanctions that were lifted under the pact. US-based political analyst Robert Nyman explains the consequences of Trump's move on his relations with the Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Defense Minister James Mattis on the other.
President Trump is trying to work with elements in Congress to add new demands on Iran. Nobody can say now how that's going to play out. But there's no question about it that it's bad that the government of the United States is behaving in this way and threatening new confrontation with Iran across the region. So it's not just a question of threatening the Iran nuclear accord. The government of the United States, the Trump administration, is threatening escalation and confrontation ostensibly against Iran throughout the region, including in cases where really the Iran role is small, according to most experts, and the humanitarian consequences of such escalation would be disastrous. I'm thinking particularly of Yemen.
Donald Trump did actually talk about Yemen and about what he called Iran's nefarious role in Yemen, in the ongoing conflict in Yemen that pitches Saudi Arabia against the Houthi rebels who have taken power there.
And unfortunately, in the United States, among the, let's say, right-wing democratic foreign policy elite, there's a belief that this is the place where the United States can confront Iran at low cost. The Trump administration has openly embraced a framework for U.S. policy in the region of going all in with Saudi Arabia, and this risks escalating the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. The positive thing I can say is that for the first time, there's a group of members of Congress that are openly challenging this policy in Yemen and demanding that the U.S. end its military participation in Saudi Arabia's war and blockade.
This is very much part of these issues between the United States, Trump administration, and Iran today.
According to the choice of the Trump administration, it is. But of course, many people, including me, would contest that this is the way that U.S. policy should be organized. It's not the job of the United States government to maintain Saudi Arabia's hegemony in Yemen, in Bahrain, in the Gulf. That's not a vital national security interest of the United States.
Going back to specifically the six-party agreement plus Iran, has the U.S. gained anything since Obama agreed that?
Well, if you think that the goal was and should have been, and the goal of U.S. policy was and should have been, to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon, then the United States gained tremendously, because Iran agreed in these negotiations to an unprecedentedly intrusive inspection regime, which the IAEA has said repeatedly that Iran is complying with, and that gives unprecedentedly strong assurance through the life of agreement that Iran will not acquire a nuclear weapon. And even after the 10 or 15 years, Iran is still a member of the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, still a signatory of additional protocol, and still under strong U.S. international scrutiny. So if that's the goal, the U.S. benefited tremendously. Of course, what has been true the whole time is that there's this other set of goals of Saudi Arabia, of the UAE, of Israel, of the hardline faction, for whom this was never really about Iranian nuclear weapons. It was a proxy for the question of struggle for power between the Israel, Saudi Arabia, UAE interests who want to maintain the status quo, their hegemony in the region, and what they see as the threat of rising Iranian power and influence, and rapprochement between Iran and the United States.
Robert Nyman speaking to RFI's Roslyn Hyams there. Now, Chad has pulled hundreds of troops out of the Diffa region in neighbouring Niger, where they'd been stationed as part of the fight against Nigeria's Boko Haram group. This comes after US President Donald Trump put Chad on his revised travel ban. Clea Broadhurst spoke to Yann St-Pierre, a counter-terrorism expert with the group Modern Security in Berlin. He says Chad's pullout shouldn't be attributed to Trump's decision.
I think it's convenient. It will have an effect, especially, you know, following, well, the very public knowledge that the American troops are present in Niger, although that was an open secret already. I think it has more to do with Chad and having its own problems. It has a lot of problems in the south of its to its southern border. And also, right now, there's a lot of concern to the northern border. That it required a there was a change in governor, there was a change in military strategy to the northern part of the country. There's a lot of rumors that they might even get involved in southern Libya. So I wouldn't be surprised if redeploying the troops from Niger to somewhere else in Chad would actually be more linked to its own needs rather than to foreign policy.
So how significant is this withdrawal? How could that change the fight in the region?
It's very significant, especially for Niger, because right now Niger is fighting on three fronts. So that's Diffa region to the south. It's fighting to the west in the Soum region, the tri-border area with Burkina Faso and Mali, and it's also having its problems, of course, with southern Libya, so to the north of Niger, and it was already a very thin army to begin with. It's an army that is already way overstretched. And so with Chad pulling out of the southern region, where thanks to that, Niger could afford to invest more on other fronts, that recreates a situation where Niger will have to invest more troops or redeploy more troops to Difa, and that already has a very significant effect. Apparently, crime is up already, but I think in the upcoming days and weeks, we'll start seeing more attacks by Boko Haram because the Nigerian army is stretched so thin.
I was going to ask you, how might Boko Haram see this would it see it as an opportunity?
Absolutely. It's really for them. They'll see it as an opportunity to strike because, you know, it'll be difficult. There'll be less opposition. They'll be able to move goods around much better. They'll be able to operate a bit, way better. So for them, it's definitely, unfortunately, a blessing. And they'll definitely find a way to exploit it.
Now, as you mentioned, already residents in Niger's Difa region have said they've seen an increase in banditry. Now, what would it take for Chad to come back?
Well, I think at this point, money. For them, they'll have to be a political and strategic incentive for them to return. It'll have to be worth their while. I think they did it for a period because it helped them as well. But if they feel right now that they have the situation under control and that they need their own troops, then redeploying these troops will have to be compensated in some way. So I don't think the seriousness, or I don't think more attacks by Boko Haram in Difa will incite Chad to redeploy its troops, but it could be a bargaining chip. So I would expect it to be very expensive, whether it be politically or financially, for Chad to redeploy its troops there.
So in terms of the international powers as well, what would it take to tip the balance in the region then?
Well, I think it would be, in that case, I think Nigeria would probably have to get more involved. That means, in a way, that the MJTF as a whole understand that they might have to invest more resources into the Difa region. That would mean also that Niger would have to invest more. Now, if we're talking about Western powers getting involved, there's a lot of rumors as well following the debacle in Tingo Tongo in Niger last week, that the U.S. might be preparing an operation in Niger. Now, if that's true and that does come to happen, that could play a role as well. That, you know, could be another bargaining chip. So there's a lot of moving pieces. There's a lot of factors there for Western, in terms of Western powers getting involved. There might be also an interest in saying, well, okay, we'll try to put pressure in southern Libya to try to relieve the pressure in northern Chad. So there's a lot of factors getting involved, but I don't see much how international pressure, aside from money and maybe more investments from the U.S. and France, could really sway the Chadian government to redeploy troops to southern Niger.
You're listening there to Yann St-Pierre from Modern Security. It's time now for international media, and this week we look at foreign correspondents travelling abroad. And when they do, they often work with fixers, who are locals who know all the ins and outs and the do's and don'ts, and help journalists navigate the politics and culture of the place. In this week's edition, we hear why being a fixer, is often a tricky job.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of International Media. In this week's programme, we'll look at a move by France to create a fund aimed at supporting YouTubers. We'll also look at the plight of fixers in dangerous zones. They are often forgotten by the general press, but they too risk their lives by helping journalists work on a story.
International Media.
Here in France, the National Centre of Cinema, CNC, has just launched a new fund aimed at helping online video creators create content on YouTube, Dailymotion or Vimeo. The overall goal is to help YouTubers to create better content and experiment more. Video makers will be able to apply for help and will then be selected by the CNC. France's CNC already heavily funds the French cinema industry. €355 million were spent by the organization last year, which explains in part the vitality of the French film industry. Julien Neutre, CNC's creation director, explains why it decided to create the new fund.
It's very simple. It's to support new creators with two main goals. First, create artistic leap. second one, to structure a new ecosystem.
So basically what's going to happen is that people will have to submit projects and then you'll pick them. How, you know, what criteria are you going to use? How much money are you going to give for projects?
Same as usual, in our system, professional committees will decide the support and the level of support we will give to the proposals, the creative proposals. We adapt it, of course, but we take the same main principles that drive our support.
Can you actually finance the creation of contents online the way you finance movies in France? Does it work the same way?
On the principles, yes, but we needed to adapt our system, our ways of accompanying these creations. We found new ways because we need to be adapted to new ways of creating and producing, especially with a new rhythm. So we will act fast and we will support very fast the creators with cycles of 2 months only between the presentation, the proposals, and the support, the financial support.
So that fund will amount of about, I think, 2 million euros. Right now in France, the CNC is spending around 30 million euros each year on movies. Could we imagine in the future you would use more money to finance online projects?
It depends on the evolution. We will follow the evolution of this new ecosystem. And the idea is to be adapted to the level and the needs of the creators. Today, the 2 million euros are the good level to create this artistic leap and to structure this new ecosystem.
That was Julien Neutre, the CNC's creation director, speaking from Paris. At the beginning of this month, the Bayeux Calvados War Correspondent Award chose to pay tribute to Bakhtiar Haddad, an Iraqi journalist and fixture who was killed last June by a landmine in Mosul. Haddad had helped numerous French and international journalists reporting on Iraq and Syria. But have you ever heard of fixers? They're an often overlooked profession, working alongside journalists all over, but especially in difficult zones. Their role is to help reporters carry on their mission, find contacts, and so on. And their role is crucial for war reporters, but their lives are often put at risk. Catherine Monet, Reporters Without Borders deputy editor, explains.
They are really people who open doors, not only because they help to open interviews, because they have better connection, or they have just connection because they are from the country or the zone where the reporter is working. They can help to secure the journalist because of the connection, they can know better the limits if you can go or not in this area. You know, they are supposed to know a bit better, you know, how far the journalist can go in an unstable environment. So they are also, if I can say, a bit reporters' guardian angel.
What kind of risks are they taking, especially in war zones?
The main problem, you know, is journalists leave, they go back home, but fixer stays. And their asset of being local can become really their biggest weakness, because not only they can become a target for, in some areas, you know, the danger not only comes from the front line, it can come only but being in a country like Iraq, for example, or Afghanistan, working for foreign media can make you a nice target for harm groups that kidnap just for ransom or just for killing. And also another problem for fixers that they are, you know, helping to cover. And so this proximity sometimes can really deepen the moral, the psychological ones.
Not a lot of people know about fixers, even amongst journalists. Why do you think those people, this profession, is often overlooked?
I think there is many reasons for that. We call them the shadow reporters sometimes. It's usually, you know, they are considered just like assistant. They are not the main reporter. They are just helping. And they are multitasked. They don't have a definite, really, job. And they are as I said, they are often assistants, and it's usually only the reporter who is having the credit of the report and not them. And this is one of the things that maybe we suggest, is at least to try to give them visibility and recognition by giving their names in the credits of the report, which is not happening so often.
I'm guessing this situation is why you've decided at Reporters Without Borders to keep a separate log of events for fixers.
As they are sometimes local journalists, as they are also just a translator, the case whenever they are killed, because so far there's been at least five fixers killed, mainly in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and also one case in Gaza. So far they are recorded as either journalist or translator, but not as fixer, which is really their job. And it's really at that time when they have been killed or when they have been kidnapped, that was occupation, the job they were having, they were doing.
I want to ask you a question about what we can do to help those fixers. I'm wondering if one solution could be, for example, let's say in Iraq, someone help a journalist, and then could France, for example, welcome them as refugees if their life is threatened on the ground?
Reporters Without Borders helped some fixers to flee out from their country with the help also with the main media they were working with. But definitely one thing is to be very careful about the risk that maybe they can take by working on the ground. One of the exposure is because they are local, because they are from the country, they can easily be considered as spy by one of the parties in conflict, which doesn't really happen with foreign journalists. And also, you know, if anything turns wrong after the report has been published, they are still on the ground when also the reporter is back home. For example, we had cases that like weeks or even 6 months after a report has been published, one of the character of the report has been killed. Once it was in Afghanistan by an American drone. The fixer who helped to cover the story 6 months ago really went under threat because the people were convinced, the Taliban group, actually, they had followed 6 months before with the journalists, with a French team, actually. And they were convinced, the Taliban were convinced that the fixer gave some information to the American troops. In this case, the threats have been so high, so difficult. It lasted more than several months, actually. The fixer tried to hide first in Afghanistan, then he tried to hide afterwards in Pakistan. And it's only then that a journalist called to Reporters Without Borders and warned about this case. And we helped the fixer to get out and actually to arrive in France.
This was Catherine Monet, deputy editor with Reporters Without Borders in Paris.
And that was Fabien Yannick Charbonnel with International Media. This is Paris Live. Time now to take a look at the French weekly magazines with William Niebuhr. William, hello.
Hi to you, James. We'll begin with a portrait of Liberian presidential candidate George Weah. It's published by L'Express, as the magazine picked him as his favourite to become the West African country's next leader. With three quarters of polling stations counted, the indications are that the former football superstar and the incumbent vice president, Joseph Boakai, are heading for a rerun. George Weah Goes on the Attack is the title of the beautiful article by a special correspondent dispatched to Nairobi, to Monrovia, I beg your pardon, by the Express, to keep track of the extraordinary bid for the ex-Monaco and Paris Saint-Germain superstar for this country's highest office. The Express says that his life has the trappings of a fairy tale story, adding that the fans of the King and the 1995 Ballon d'Or laureate are hoping that he will be the same prolific goal scorer at the helm of the country as he was during his fantastic football career. This week's Marianne takes up new embarrassing revelations about skimmings at the Hague-based International Criminal Court, which it claims undermined the political neutrality of the institution currently trying the former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo. This is after findings by nine media establishments, including the French investigative website Mediapart, that the judicial procedure launched against Gbagbo was carried out for the exclusive benefit of one of the parties in the Ivorian crisis, the country's current president, Alassane Ouattara. according to the left-leaning weekly, some 40,000 confidential documents, which the media group laid hands on, show that Luis Moreno Ocampo, who was prosecutor of the ICC at the time, was in contact with a French diplomat in Ouattara after French-backed forces overthrew Gbagbo and handed him over to pro-Ouattara rebels. Marianne claims that despite a denial by Paris, a controversial email shows that Ocampo asked his partners, meaning Ouattara, and President Sarkozy's government in Paris to detain Gbagbo until an African country files a case against him at the International Criminal Court. According to Marianne, there was no legal basis at the time warranting the ICC to begin judicial proceedings against Laurent Gbagbo. Yet, as the publication observes, Laurent Luis Moreno Ocampo, who flew to Abidjan in June 2012 for a meeting with Ouattara, didn't hesitate to speak his mind that it was Gbagbo and his supporters who were responsible for what he termed serious crimes. And Mariam wonders on what serious investigation his claims were based. Furthermore, the left-leaning weekly reports that since the opening of Laurent Gbagbo's trial in January 2016, Moreno Ocampo's successor, Gambia's Fatou Bensouda, has been dumbfounded by the collapse of depositions made against Gbagbo by witnesses. Still, as Marianne points out, that hasn't stopped the court from rejecting a 12th application from the defense for Laurent Gbagbo to be released on bail. And this week's Le Canard Enchaîné satirizes about President Emmanuel Macron's tough ride in the Sahel quicksand as he lobbies Mali, Chad, Niger, Burkina Faso and Mauritania to mobilize troops for an anti-terrorism force capable of replacing the 4,500-strong Barkhane French operation.
Thanks very much.